From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Displayed, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are exhibiting your game and design investigations. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
So Stephen, Lydia and I have some numbers to report to you.
Oh, numbers. I like numbers.
Really important, small numbers.
Oh, small numbers.
Smaller than had been recorded previously.
Oh, okay.
Because what, Lydia?
Well, for my birthday, we went on to an escape room, trapped puzzle rooms in St. Paul.
Right. I heard about that. Yeah.
It was fun. And apparently, we were good enough that we broke the records of two rooms.
What?
One by 3 minutes and one by 1 second.
What?
Yeah. And we have photographic proof.
And I wasn't there.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, man.
I know.
I was getting beat down in a board game, so.
I know, bummer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. Lydia brought myself and a bunch of other of her friends to escape room, video game themed.
And Dale.
Was nice. And
Dale
was there.
Yeah.
We tore through it in 20 minutes. Beat the record by 3 minutes. And then the person running it said, like, I don't think you got your money's worth.
Yeah.
Do you want to do another one?
And we were like, sure, so long as it's okay for you. And
yeah.
Then we did that and we beat it by 1 second.
Yep. Wow. Meanwhile, I couldn't get enough hummingbirds.
Oh, bummer.
This is the wingspan expansion?
Wingspan expansion that adds a hummingbird mechanic where you like have hummingbirds come back and forth on your board.
And you're bad at it?
I'm not great.
Which expansion is it?
It's the American expansion.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I've only ever played base game, actually.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Which is wild because I love that game. I haven't played any of the expansions yet.
The expansions have added more. I think my main complaint with... I like Wingspan, but like it's not my favorite game, but it's largely because there's not a lot of interactivity between all the different players.
Yeah.
But they've added more interactivity in each of the expansions. So I guess you could scale your interactivity depending on how much you like that or not.
Well, speaking of interactivity with other players, when we were doing the escape rooms, one of the things that was interesting about it as a designer, Lydia and I talked a little bit about this after the fact, is like it was Trapped, the company that does, they do a location in St. Paul, a location in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
They're very good at this.
They're really good.
Yeah, the designs were very good. And they we had eight people, which is, you know, probably partly owes to our record setting time.
Yeah.
But when you have a lot of people, one of the problems with an escape room is coordinating communication.
Yeah.
And I think this group was good at that.
Yeah.
But also, I think the design was such that we didn't have to be very good at it.
Yeah, there is both a issue of communication between players, and also you need to make sure that the puzzles are laid out and organized and staggered enough that you are always feel like you're working towards a common goal. But you never hit a point where you're like, oh, too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Right. And you don't really need, like, I mean, I think, like, if you're, like, have a team of friends who loves escape rooms, you'll kind of fall into roles. There'll be someone who's, like, a captain or whatever.
Sure.
But, like, when you just go, you don't do any of that kind of planning. Mm-hmm. And a good design is one that doesn't require that to be good at it.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of what we ended up with.
Yeah.
Like, nobody needed to stand up and be, like, the one who's, like, funneling information back and forth to people.
Mm-hmm.
And we still were able to be very efficient and share information we needed. It was good.
Yeah.
Both rooms had pretty good design.
Yeah. And so this is the fourth room I've done with them. I did two for my bachelorette weekend in the Minneapolis branch. This is my first time at the St. Paul branch. And every time I've gone, the GMs have also been absolutely fantastic.
That's nice.
Yeah. They've been very nice and accommodating and wonderful people.
Yeah.
Have not had a bad experience. 10 out of 10, would recommend.
Yeah. Oh, and one thing that you noted sort of narratively about the way they do their rooms is that even though they're quote unquote escape rooms, they're always structured. I mean, of course, you can always leave an escape room. You're not actually locked in a room.
Yeah.
But in this one, all their scenarios are such that even in the fictional world, you're not locked.
Yeah.
You're always trying to get a different goal.
They are always objective based. So you're always trying to do something. You are never in a position where you are trying to leave the room. You are always trying to achieve something within the room. And that's also very important because they do say, like, we do not lock you in. You can leave at any time to go to the bathroom. The one thing they say is, like, we are not going to stop the clock if you leave the room.
Yeah.
So if you need to, like, leave the room for whatever reason, like, You just need to not be in a room. You need to go to the bathroom. You need to take a break. We will not stop the clock, but you're allowed to do that.
Nice.
And especially, I know Ian really does not like the idea of escape rooms because does not like the idea of being trapped.
Yeah, yeah.
That actually, again, I was saying, like, hey, this is a thing, and that is something that they really appreciated. It's also they had even in the rooms that are smaller spaces,
yeah,
never felt claustrophobic, and we never got on top of each other.
Yeah.
Which, considering there was 8 people, is pretty dang impressive.
Yeah, the first one we did was actually a relatively small space, but still everyone had a it had like multiple zones, so every zone was actually even half the size of that small room already. But we all had places to stand. It didn't feel that cramped. No. The second one was much bigger.
Yeah.
And that felt more like, oh, this is a room for a big group. But we had just done the one that was much smaller that did not feel cramped. So it was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a function of the size of the space.
Yeah. So, yeah, cannot recommend enough. And we will post in the show notes the photos of us in record-breaking time. So if you go and you beat our records, let us know.
Yeah. Also, let us know if you go and they just tell you you beat a record no matter how well you do. I could see that being a thing, because who really compares?
Sure.
We didn't do that for me previously.
I mean, so. Okay, all right. I mean, I'm assuming we did beat the record, but I'm willing to entertain a possibility where it was just a nice thing that you tell everybody when they leave.
I don't know. I think that we're pretty smart.
I think so, too.
Yeah. In other news, following being smart and getting smart, I am on Tuesday, so a couple days from when we're recording, I'm going to be taking a Microsoft Excel course.
Oh, it's just spreadsheets!
I know. It's going to be, I think, 2 hours or 2.5 hours on a Tuesday night. And it's through Minneapolis Community Ed through their adult enrichment. I'm cool. Taking just the first one to see if I like the teacher before I commit to more 2 hours at night learning Microsoft Excel from the same person.
Yeah, that's real.
But that was one thing that I learned in both just encountering things at work and also at GDC learning from narrative designers and stuff, is that it's really helpful to learn Excel and anything that you can do to make life easier for you in spreadsheets. Both in general, but also specifically the fields that I'm interested in. And so that's something that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I would also, we get the catalog every half year. Okay, and I always love looking through it and going, ah, dang, there's so many classes that I can't take. Or I actually am able to take some classes. Mm-hmm. And so I do recommend that you look in the community ed space. Usually it's through the public school system. But they have in your local area, whether it's the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul have separate ones, or if it is just wherever you are, take a look at what's local in your community ed or your adult education space, because there might be some really cool things you can learn that relate to your game dev, but maybe you wouldn't have thought to do, or you just don't want to do on your own.
It can also be stuff that doesn't relate to game dev.
That's true.
Potentially bring into game dev. Yeah. I know this is a game dev podcast, so that's why we're bringing it in that angle. But if you just want to learn how to paint, you can learn how to paint and then, I don't know, make a paint-based game. That'd be neat.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we talked in last episode about it, but if there's a figure drawing class, you could maybe...
Wait. We're not going to make this the new 2026 Stephen Do a thing.
Okay, Stephen, fine. We won't. Let's be nice. So, Stephen, how's that fishing minigame?
Heck!
I will say, so tomorrow I'm going to take a course called Getting to Know Your Sewing Machine, which, side note, I own a sewing machine from the 1800s, and I kind of wanted to bring that in as a bit.
Right. And you're more acquaintances than friends at the moment?
No, it is the first, I am the fifth generation woman to learn how to sew on that machine.
Okay.
There's a different, more modern one I wanted to learn. That's from the 80s.
Okay.
But I did think that'd be funny. And then I'm taking the Excel one. I'm going to be taking a 3-hour course on first aid at some point.
Yeah.
And then the other one I think I'm taking is, what is it? It's secular tarot for journaling. So the idea is hey, let's use tarot cards and use that as a prompt or lens to then explore and journal.
Huh. Okay.
I think of it very similar in the idea of Jesse Schell and his lenses.
Right.
Design book. Where it's you pull out, you look at it through a lens, and then what can you do with that?
It's an artificial framework to get to a real thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. And since I love so many video games that have tarot, especially Persona, I'm also excited to kind of engage with that. And
nice.
So anyway, look through your community ed magazine or online catalog. It is cool. There's lots of cool stuff.
Yeah.
All right, I got a topic today.
Do ya?
We talked about this very early in the life of the show.
Yeah.
But as Steven, you and I are continually facing the reality of, the show's been on for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And some of those early episodes go way, way back.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to say how far.
Yeah, Luke is old now.
But
Dang.
All of us, Lydia. All of us are old.
Yeah.
Anyway, we talked about demoing your game.
Yeah.
But we also sort of, it was episode 15 of the show for folks who want to look back and see. I have not gone back to listen to it. I'm a little scared.
Okay.
But we'd also talked about playtesting. And so we've talked about both of those things in the show quite often since.
Yeah.
But we haven't, I don't think we've done it as a full topic again. And I've been thinking about it recently just because I've been talking to people and it's just come up a few times.
Sure.
Where people talk about like, oh, I really want to show my thing at a local convention or, you know, I want to take it somewhere. And I'm getting business cards printed or, you know, whatever reason. And I'm hearing this from veteran developers in our scene, but also some newer developers who are maybe doing this for the first or second time.
Yeah.
And thinking about like all the things I've learned over the years, why I don't do it so much anymore.
Yeah.
And all the different contexts that it can apply. I thought, well, it's been on my mind, even though it's not something I'm actually doing at the moment. Mm. I thought I would sort of revisit this and see if we can get it, kind of broaden it and sort of talk about it from every angle. So the first thing I want to talk about is like the context of this, of like if you're showing your game off at some event or some place, there is many different ways for that to happen where it can all feel sort of the same.
Yeah.
So the sort of first and maybe lowest stakes place would be showing it at like a developer meetup.
Oh, sure.
You bring it around, you have it on a laptop or something, and you just have other people play it to see how it goes. You're trying to get feedback. You're maybe not running a formal play test, but you're just trying to like tell people, hey, I made a thing, right? Then a step up from that is more of a play test event. So we do that here in the Twin Cities every month here at Noble Robot. We have a very structured system where I handle all the presentation stuff.
So right.
You're not expected to bring any kind of equipment, controllers, signage, any of that stuff.
Yeah.
But there are many playtest events that other communities run where you bring in your own gear, find a corner of the space and set up. And it is kind of like showcasing. Mm-hmm. Past that, you have conferences. So also working, generally seeing with your peers, either you're invited because of as part of a showcase, or you're tabling to demo it off.
Okay. Oh, I was going to say, this is something that I have shown games off at conventions, but not at a conference. Oh. And I think, Lydia, you probably have a lot more experience with showing things off at conferences versus me.
I have done it once.
Oh, okay.
I did it.
That's already more than me.
Yeah, I did it at my previous job. We went to the EdTech Expo in Washington, D.C.
Ah, okay.
And we brought the game we were working on to that.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
And the last category is the one that you teased, which is conventions.
Yes.
So this is showing to the public.
Yes.
We all have some experience with that.
Yeah.
To some degree. I think the key of laying out these things is like, it's sort of obvious, but in my experience, developers tend to do the same thing at all of these places.
Sure.
They set up in the same way. They talk to people in the same way.
Yeah.
They kind of generally... and this isn't true of everybody, but there's sort of the first impulse to do this is to treat everybody like a potential player, a potential customer, or to treat nobody like that.
Yeah.
It kind of just depends, I sort of, on your attitude,
sure.
I guess. You're either showing it off at a convention and trying to get playtest feedback, or you're showing it off at a conference or a meetup and like handing out your like Steam page QR code or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the sort of first lesson you learn when you start showing your game to people is like understanding the context.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that frustrates me kind of a lot to see people spend a lot of energy getting up their perfect setup for demoing their games and not understanding the context necessarily. And then it's not like it's a waste of time, but it's time that they could be more, they could optimize a little bit.
You'll get less out of it. That's interesting that you bring it up in that way, because I definitely did that. When I was showing off, because I used to show off engines all the time, and we showed it off a lot at the playtest event at Glitch years ago. And so I think whenever we showed it off at a convention, I would treat it more similar to a playtest event than I would.
You had your notebook out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we would be constantly fixing things on as we were working on it, or as the convention went on. I mean, that was how I found it to be most useful.
Yeah.
Because like, I think after a certain point, you just kind of realize that like showing it off at 2DCon, as nice as 2DCon is, it's not going to sell a bunch of copies of your game.
Right.
So
ostensibly that's the reason why you show it off at a convention,
like
a local convention, is that you want people to buy the game.
Right.
But for many years, all the local conventions around here in the Twin Cities, and I think this has changed a little bit. But years ago, when I also started showing off games at these places, It was almost, it was exclusively games in development.
Yeah.
And because that was our, we had a community of people who were all working on things and hadn't released them yet.
Yep.
And that was the pool at which this, the, but we all paid a certain amount of money to show off at a thing. And all, at the end of the weekend, we maybe got some playtest feedback. Maybe we got some people sign up for mail list or something. But generally what we were doing is providing content for the event.
Yes.
And we paid for it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think I, it's one of the things, it's a little bit of a tough love thing, but I kind of want to shake people and say, like, you are not getting enough value out of this, either for your time or certainly for your money. And it's and so I've definitely stopped doing that for projects in my recent past. But it is frustrating to see people, because people, and I include myself, it really jazzes you up.
Yeah.
You see people play, you see strangers play your game and like it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It provides a lot of, like, you feel really good about doing it. It provides a lot of emotional value.
Yeah.
And you can get really good playtest feedback.
Yeah.
Especially if you treat it like a playtest event.
Right.
Yeah. And if anything, when you're so steeped in what you need to do for it, sometimes it's really productive and, as well as affirming to know what is actually working.
Right.
Because so often you don't remember or think about it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Especially with the public. Because, like, you know, if you're showing off at a playtest event, people are there to playtest it. And, like, that is, it is similar types of feedback. But, like, if you're just showing it to random people who had no anticipation of playing your game.
Yeah.
Like, and you get good feedback from that. Like, that's good. That's good sign.
Yeah. So you got to think about what you want to get out of this thing.
Yes.
And what can this thing, can, how well can this event provide that to you?
Right.
So if you have a playtest event.
Yeah.
You know, that's run by a local community, then you're going to probably get mostly other developers playing it.
Yes.
Right? Maybe some folks who are outside the wheelhouse or some members of the public, depending on the type of event that's being run.
Right, right.
And so in that situation, you also have to think about what you put into it, which is like, okay, this is going to be a bit of an artificial environment. I don't need to buy a banner. I don't need to lay out business cards. I'm just trying to get playtest player feedback. I don't need to sell the game to them.
Right.
I don't have to care if they like it. I'm just, and I'm also, I want to get people in and out as fast as possible so I can get more people to play it. And that's kind of true in all scenarios. You want, the whole point of showcasing is to put it in front of as many people as possible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that can be very difficult when you're playtesting or when you're showing it off at a place where that is a, where you're actually trying to market the game, is you'll find one or two people who are really into it, and then they like play there for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
And you're like, that is really validating. And then you realize that, like, oh no, I should have kicked them out an hour and 45 minutes ago.
Right. So someone else could play.
So someone else can see it and be exposed to it.
Yeah.
But, like, oh, here's the QR code, go buy it.
Right.
Or go download the demo or whatever.
I do like, though, and this was something we had with Tablecraft, was there was this one kid who came with his parents, and he would like linger and play when the booth was empty. And if people were approaching, he would relinquish the headset and then hang out and wait for them to be. But it was kind of nice also because then it was like, oh, someone's already always in the headset, which is then inviting for people to come and try the
that
game.
Is much more generous than I've seen other kids.
So if you're going to if you're gonna be that person, be that kid.
Yeah, for just real. Saying. That's great.
Yeah, it is nice to find, and you will, there will be people who really like being that assistant.
Mm-hmm.
They like, they love this thing and they've got some time in their convention schedule or whatever.
Yeah.
And they will sort of like help out and they'll like, they'll read it correctly. That's a great thing when that happens.
Yeah.
Another thing that's nice is if you do have a multiplayer game.
Yes.
Those are a little bit more resistant to people sticking around because those people can draw more people in.
Yeah.
I know that when I was doing showing off Metro Nexus years ago, it was nice to have somebody who was always there.
Yeah.
And then the three others would rotate in and out or whatever.
And we would do that for each other when we were there too. Sometimes.
That's actually true. People. Yeah. To have a good community of folks to help like draw people in. Or,
yeah.
If there was four people playing my game, I knew they were fine for a little while, but they haven't been there too long. I can walk over to. And I could play Fingence with somebody else.
Right.
So they're not playing by themselves.
Yeah.
So the context of that is pretty relevant.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what you're getting out of it is really important. So if you're trying to just get playtest feedback, any of these environments will work.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you need to, if you're paying money to get a table at an event and you're not there to market it, like that can feel like maybe you shouldn't have done that. But at the same time, if you're there to playtest, that's just you're paying for a playtest environment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is actually something that people do.
Yeah.
Now it's, so that means that you have to really focus on what getting good playtest feedback. So you need to helpful to screen record gameplay, take lots of notes, interview people. Don't just tell them what, you know, introduce, don't try to talk about the game like it's this cool game I made. I'll tell you the story of me making the game.
Right.
Aren't you excited about it? Like start asking probing questions. Like don't worry if they loved it or not. And don't worry, if they like it, don't worry about getting them to love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's not your job in that moment. And it's really hard to do that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can do that at an event that's not necessarily designed for that, right? Yeah. Because if you don't have an opportunity to playtest elsewhere. But it's important to be focused on what you want to get out of it and use the time you have and the money you're spending mm-hmm. to get that thing out of it.
May I also say build dev tools so that way you can get into the part of the game that you want playtested as quickly as possible.
Yes.
To bypass certain things or make a specific build that is the little sandbox zone that has what you want, because you don't want people to have to sit through the minute and a half long intro in order to get to the gameplay, because as Mark said, you want a higher turnover.
Yeah,
right. That's a really good point, because when we were playtesting Widget Satchel,
yeah.
that's a campaign. It has five yes. levels, and each one is a little longer than the last. And so it takes a couple hours to get through mm-hmm. if you're going through it. And so we would not be able to get playtesters in a playtest environment to that area. So
yeah.
when we were playtesting at a local event, at a playtesting event, we would introduce it to people. We'd say, you're starting at level 4. This is what you should already know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little artificial. Don't worry about it. Yeah. And then we would have to then interpret. It isn't a pure playtest if they don't right. have that information from playing.
Yeah.
But... And you do have to introduce some folks. In a public environment, you kind of have to sneak it by people, right? Mm-hmm. And having dev tools, you can do that on the fly is really helpful. Mm-hmm. If someone is having a good time, you can say like, oh, I see you're having difficulty with this. Let me move you to this other part of the game where your experience might help me get some feedback on this part of it.
Yeah.
And that can be very useful. Now, building those kinds of dev tools is easier said than done. But it's helpful to be able to, yeah, not expect everyone to start from the beginning, which you will have almost certainly at a certain point have gotten plenty of feedback on.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. In order to get to the parts where you don't have a lot of feedback, mm-hmm. which is something that a Widget Satchel, we ended up, I mean, just as it went, we didn't get as much
right.
feedback on the later levels.
Yeah.
Because it's just so much harder to get.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Even though we did have tools that let you zip to each thing and we had lots of opportunities to show it, we still, even in that environment, we still weren't, I don't think, got as much as we wanted.
It was difficult to set up. There was a lot of setup that was involved in order to get somebody to level 4 or 5 or whatever.
Yeah.
And by setup, I don't even necessarily mean just like literally having the dev tools, but also just like people need to know how to play the game, but also all the extra stuff that is in 4 that they didn't see in the other
yeah.
level.
Oh, yeah, because ideally it's a game that builds on itself with cumulative knowledge.
Yep.
And if you're plonking someone in without that cumulative knowledge, then it is understandably... disorienting and disadvantaging them.
Right.
You have to live in the knowledge that it's not going to be, you're not going to get perfect feedback,
yeah.
but you have to sort of do your best you can with it.
Yeah.
So, okay, leaving all that behind,
right.
and talking about, like, let's say you have a game that's finished
mm-hmm.
or you have a demo maybe,
yeah.
and now you actually want to show it to people and actually try to get the people you're showing it to interested in buying it.
Yes.
This is, I think, what most people think about when they think about exhibiting your games. I think when you're in a developer community, people want to start showing it before that. And so you have the experience we've been talking to about up to now.
Yeah.
So that's why it's kind of important to talk about that. But once you are ready to show it off in a way that is trying to get wish lists, trying to get people on mailing lists,
mm-hmm.
trying to get people to download a demo or buy the game, mm-hmm. There are some things similar. And you think of it almost in the opposite way. You will have lots of opportunities to show it off at meetups, at playtest events. You do not need to do that.
Yeah.
The game is not... if your goal is to get people interested or excited about it, you are wasting your time in places that you think would be easy to show it at.
Yeah, the developers aren't your audience.
Right. And I think it's sort of the culture we have here in the Twin Cities. Mm. I think people learn that very quick.
Yeah.
But there's definitely been new people who show up with their business cards.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, that's not, you know, they just don't know yet.
Yeah.
It's not like it's, you know, you don't want to be, and if you encounter those people, be kind to them.
Mm.
But also let them know that, like, you know, or, you know, when they join a Discord, we'll wish each other's games, we'll buy each other's games to support each other.
Yeah.
But actually, we are not each other's audience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think that actually is a little bit hard for people to hear sometimes
yeah.
really early if they're naive about this stuff. And so if you're the person to tell that person, be gentle and be understanding and know that, like, you probably thought that too at one point.
Send them this episode.
yeah. Hey. And yes, and if this is you that we're talking to, I mean, it can be sometimes hard to hear, because
yeah.
actually getting in front of people who, like, it's actually kind of easy when you meet up with a community, then those people are easy to talk to. They probably like you already.
Yeah.
Or they're the type of people who you can get along with. Like, they feel like, you know, that you actually, this is an environment in which I can share my work.
Yeah.
But sharing your work is different than selling your work.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes it's easy to conflate those two things.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that's a really important point, because I do think it there's a lot of value in showing it to fellow game developers, just based off the fact that, like, they can, you're committing to doing this thing.
Yes.
Right? Like, if you're showing it to somebody, then they have to acknowledge you did a thing, and you have to acknowledge you've been working on the thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you're just working in your basement for, you know, 6 months, and you never show anyone, you don't have to tell anyone, and then you could just be like, oh, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Right. Stop.
But if you have intentions and you really want to do that, it is valuable to show it to people. That being said, it is not valuable to show it to people with the intention of hoping they will pay you money to buy this thing unless it's the correct audience. Mm-hmm. That's what Mark has been saying.
Yeah. So if you got all that, if you're past all that,
yep.
and you understand the correct context, mm-hmm. and you're gonna table a convention with your game and you're gonna try to sell it.
Yeah.
This is where you want to make sure that you focus on getting as many first impressions as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that can be making a demo of the game that is not exactly what the game is.
Yeah.
Either by giving people a little bit more power-ups or giving people letting them start at level 3.
Yeah.
So they can just get an idea of the core loop rather than watching the 30-second cutscene at the beginning, which might be something that as you've playtested all these times, you realize, oh, I need to get rid of that 30-second playtest or that 30-second cutscene.
Mm-hmm.
That is something, just going back to playtesting, you also want to make sure you're getting the right signals from people.
Right.
Because when you playtest and people just want to get into it, you're like, oh, this intro cutscene is way too long.
Yeah.
That's because it's preventing you from getting more people to play, and that's your goal in that environment.
Yes.
But then that's also a separate context from the person who already bought the game.
Yeah.
So when you're back to like showcasing to try to sell the thing.
Yeah.
If you're demoing it, and you might want to skip the opening cutscene so that more people can experience the game.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not evidence you should cut the cutscene out of your game.
Yes.
Right? Because even when you're showing it to potential players, those people are not players.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
Like it's everything is different. And I think that takes a while to understand. When you put someone in front of your game, they are going to be way different from someone who's already been convinced to buy it and is sitting at home at their desk and ready to boot it up.
Yeah.
Where you can give them a slower start and that can be really valuable, where you just drop them in and you're standing over them and they also have different needs at that moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not necessarily there to do it as quick as possible so they can move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, all of that is to say that like it is very difficult sometimes to understand how different all these contexts are.
Yes.
Even when they sometimes look literally exactly the same, like physically they look the same.
Yeah.
And so think about what you want for when you're trying to sell your game at a convention or some other kind of event where you're showing it off.
Mm-hmm.
This comes down then to not just the game itself, but you know, do you have like business cards with QR codes to share the thing?
Yeah.
Do you have like a sale, like a coupon code, which you can do on Itch is a good example of you can give people codes that will just get them a private sale, mm-hmm. Which is kind of fun. Another thing about thinking about, like, do you have a multiplayer game, which means you don't have to worry about people staying there for too long if there's multiple seats.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you have a single player game, especially if it's like an RPG kind of game where you actually, in order to get an impression, you kind of can only cheat so much. People do need to play for 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Then you want to think about multiple stations. And what does that mean? Do you need, you know, can it run on a low power laptop? Can you borrow some old equipment and get 3 stations at a table? Like, is that something that you can do? If you can only do one station on a big screen, then maybe you need to make it something, your table something where people could stand by and watch and not play.
Yeah.
I'm actually a huge proponent of that for a couple, just having that in general for a couple different reasons. One, if you want to show live gameplay, then you can have people watch just the person going through it live.
Yeah.
And especially if someone is shy or they're unsure if it's something that they want to commit time to, or they know that they can't because like they have to go to lunch in 5 minutes or go to a talk.
Yeah.
That gives them the ability to engage and see what you have without engaging fully, is good for many reasons, not even the least, just some people are really awkward in contexts where they know that they are going to be sold to, right?
Yeah.
But also, if it is something where the gameplay will be, as someone's figuring out, it will be very disorienting to watch, uh-huh. like a live feed, then you can have a separate screen that shows essentially what your ideal Let's Play would be. Which is what we did for our game because it was in VR.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing for that is like we wanted to show kind of ideally what you would do, have that available as like a little bit of a tutorial before people go in so they have a bit of a guidance. But also because for us in VR specifically, people can get simulation sick. And so anyone who was interested in the game but felt that they couldn't be in the headset, that was a good way for us to still engage with them one-on-one personally with the product.
Right.
Without them having to get into the headset and play. I would also say, as someone who is only good at, like, not great at some games, if I get to see what is happening, but I don't have to engage with it, that will be more meaningful to me than if I play.
Yes.
Like if it was a first person shooter or a 3D platformer, which I would be garbage at, I would not actually be able to play and access as much of it.
Yeah.
So I'm a huge proponent of having like the monitor that shows people, the bystanders, what is going on.
Yeah. I used to have a tablet that I read, like a 10-inch tablet, like a cheapo Android tablet that I would run a looping trailer on. I think at one of the games, I forget which one of it, that I put in a an attract mode. I did it for Metro Nexus.
Oh yeah.
But with Widget Satchel, once it got closer to release, we couldn't add. I didn't want to make a demo version
for sure.
Yeah. I just didn't have the capacity for it. So I really leaned on having the extra screen that did the trailer, because when no one was playing, it was just the title screen.
Yeah.
You want to think about. Like, it is another form of advertisement. And so, related to that, if the game crashes, you do not investigate. Reboot the game.
And just let
someone else play.
I know that one real hard.
Yep.
If someone has playtest feedback, write it down, thank them, but, like, it's not the time for it.
Right.
You're going to think, oh, I'm going to lose this important information.
Yeah.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Now, of course, if you've got the time for it, whatever. But like, if it's between that and then welcoming two other people to play, you don't necessarily want to get into a 10-minute conversation with somebody about how exactly they got to that spot that soft locked it.
Yeah.
Like, that's not what you're there for.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Ideally, I mean, you do want to be, you yourself need to be public facing too, right?
And yeah.
Like you're sort of putting on a show. And so you need to, you want to advertise your game, but also be friendly and talk to people and things. But ideally, you have like somebody else who can help you and maybe get feedback, I guess, if you need it. But also, I think that I think that's a very good point, Mark. That like your focus is to make sure more people can play the game. When we were showing off Treasure Stack at PAX, there was a soft lock bug where in the tutorial, because it was the last thing we implemented before we showed it off, which was maybe part of the problem. It would just keep people from being able to play it. So what we had to do is we would just reset it. Each time, and I don't remember if we ever were able to fix it because PAX is all weekend, right?
Yeah.
Like I don't think we were able to fix it during the weekend, so we just had to keep resetting it.
Yeah.
And we would let people know this is a bug. We would help them through it so that they could get past it, so they could actually play the game. But like you just kind of have to deal with it fast.
And yeah.
There's something to be said for just like quickly guiding the players so that they don't get stuck in something.
I also like to congratulate them for finding a bug that we didn't find before and treat it as like a badge of honor for who.
Yeah, you can really spin
it. That's good.
People like being in on an early process. Mm-hmm. You can be like, oh, this is the latest build.
Yeah.
And so you're, you know, playing for anyone else. Then, you know, because you are trying to put your best foot forward.
Yeah.
But you know, you can't try to hide it.
Right.
Like if there's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you just focus on what it is you're there to do.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're not there to do.
And people will understand that because they understand that that's what you're here to do. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess the other key thing to it is just to think about how often you do one thing versus another thing.
Yes.
Because, like, I think especially when you're, like, a solo dev, you're working on a small team,
mm-hmm.
You don't have platform backing, let's say.
Yeah.
When you think about, like, oh, these are my opportunities.
Yeah.
I can show it off at these three places. I can demo it. I can demo it at these two or three playtest events. Be judicious. Like, what is a good use of your time? Because, like, especially like a weekend event, that's your downtime if you're working on a project. If you're working nights and weekends, that's your work time.
Yeah.
And that can take away. And if you an important thing to do, I think, is when you do one of these things, and you especially when you meet other devs, you go out to dinner afterwards, you feel a lot of value out of it. Like community value is an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And don't discount that as something you get out of it. Of course. But once that experience is over. Take a hard look and say, like, was this a valuable experience for me?
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't, then what I learned is that I shouldn't be doing this every time.
Yeah.
Or I should be more careful about saying yes to these things.
Yeah.
If it was like, oh, I got a lot of new people on my mailing list, or like I can see it was really successful, or if it's a playtest thing, I got a lot of really good feedback.
Yeah.
Then you can think about like, okay, how can I leverage that and do better, even better next time? Because it can really take a lot out of you to do this, especially if you're doing your own promotion.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to be on the whole time.
Yeah, and you have to just say, like, was this a good use of my time? And it's amazing how rarely any of us ever did that when we were starting out.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just seemed like the thing to do.
Yeah. And, well, we like you were saying before, we did get a lot of community value out of that.
Yes.
And I think we definitely didn't discount that at the time. Like, it was really useful for that purpose. But I think that we felt it was probably more important or more valuable than it actually was, and how like it helped get wish lists and stuff. Like we had copies of Witch's Satchel. I remember you were showing it off because we were showing Vengeance off at the time too. Mm-hmm. And we had copies of Witch's Satchel available for people to purchase. And I don't think we made like 10 sales, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. I think that was the one I decided. Like,
yeah.
I don't think this is like, even though we sold some copies, I don't know if it was worth the amount of effort I put into it.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a sad moment because I'd already been kind of thinking like, oh, I'm not going to show off in progress games anymore. I'm just going to show off games like I'm tabling an event, like I'm trying to sell it.
Yeah.
And even that, I was like, oh boy, I think I'm just providing content for this event more than I'm actually getting any value out of it necessarily. And that's going to be different for event. And that's also something you can give feedback to organizers.
Yes.
You know, you can be like, sorry, the table is too expensive for the value we get out of it. And, you know, and if enough people give that feedback, they can calibrate. So last thing I'll say about this, just as a summary, was you think about any of these contexts, think about what your call to action is to your player.
Yes.
If it's playtest, your call to action is right in that moment, give me your feedback.
Yes.
Then, you know, if it's, the game has a demo or it's in development, but you want to get wish lists, that is your call to action.
Yeah.
You want the player to do that, which means you need to be able to actually ask them to do it.
Yes.
That means either if you don't have a lot of materials, that means actually talking to people. If flyers, business cards, signage.
Right.
And think about having one call to action.
Yes.
Not, hey, we have a Discord and a mailing list and the demo's out and you can wish list it.
Buy it now.
It's coming out next month. And you know, I'll be at this other event and you can see then like focus on one thing.
Yes.
And then all the rest of it can flow from it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And not just, even if you have multiple things that you could make your one call to action, pick one that is most valuable now.
Yeah.
And then focus on that. Because then it's just easier.
Yeah.
Like, it's easier to convince everybody of one thing than many people of many things.
Easier to track. So that way you are only giving yourself one variable to measure the success of it. So, for example, if yours is how many copies did you sell immediately?
Yeah.
Then you know. If it's wish lists between during this weekend, now you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, and if you're trying to get people to download a demo, then think about your call to action. Like, do you really actually want that? So you're trying to get people on a mailing list to collect email addresses. Do you actually intend to send them anything?
Yeah.
If you're trying to get people to join a Discord,
Mean anything?
Are you going to be active on that Discord?
Right. Who's maintaining it?
Yeah.
If it's even worth it, yeah.
Yeah, so think about not just your call to action, but like, what are you going to do to follow up on that?
Right.
How are you going to make it worth those people's while to have done the thing you've asked them to do?
Yeah.
And if it's just buy the game, that's probably the easiest one.
Uh-huh.
But that requires, of course, you to be finished with the game and in promotional mode.
Yes.
And we should all be so lucky to finish the game to sell.
Speaking of call to action, transition.
Uh-huh.
There has been a fun conversation in the Discord recently about Godot. I think, Mark, you brought it up in an episode previously and folks glommed onto that.
Mm-hmm.
We'd love to hear your thoughts, listener, on how you feel about Godot or anything related to the show. You can go to nicegames.club/Discord and let us know and also the community. There's been a pretty decently sized conversation about specifically if Godot has made it in terms of like it being a good engine for development to like sell something.
Yeah, are you waiting for Godot to become big enough that you are going to hop onto that train?
Yeah.
He is so satisfied. that turn of phrase. You should see the big smile on Lydia's face.
It's so big.
The first person to make that joke. It's pretty sly. I like it.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. Well, I think what's nice about our Discord is I will monitor it.
Yeah.
But what's nice is that people are bringing up things that are just related to what we're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah.
So new conversations happen there. So of course people are like, let's talk about the thing that your nice host talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's better when people bring their own topics and like, you know, spin off from things we've said into their own things.
Yeah.
And then we're invited. We'll talk with listeners, but I think I love when our listeners talk to each other and share their knowledge and build that community.
Right.
Because then I have the opportunity. So just selfishly, I have the opportunity to learn some things too, which I really, really like.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And this Godot conversation was a good example of that where I was like, I think I have a thought on this. I'm like, actually, no, I'm just going to read, because there's a lot of wisdom here.
Yeah.
What people are saying.
Right, right.
So if you want to be part of dispensing and receiving that wisdom, you can go to where, Stephen?
Nicegames.club/Discord.
So I have been doing at work on and off a fair number of what we call design investigations.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So that come, I don't know if it has, but the thing that we do has a different or better term.
Okay.
But what it comes from is a little bit from how we organize our JIRA. So yeah. Whenever we have a ticket that a developer will do, we will moniker it at the very beginning, all caps, dev FE for front end or dev BE for back end.
Oh.
The foil to dev, DEV is DES or for design.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have INV, investigation.
I see.
So for example, if for example, we want to do something, but we're not entirely sure how feasible it would be, we might make a dev investigation ticket and essentially say, hey, look into, can we do this thing? Maybe prototype it to see how feasible it is. So that way we would know, is this something that we want to pursue on the roadmap? Is it something that we even can pursue?
Oh my goodness. I love this.
Oh, it's great, right?
Yeah, this is amazing.
I think that they're kind of fun.
Yeah.
The foil to that is design investigations.
Mm.
And what that is very much in my wheelhouse.
Okay.
What that typically is an analysis of the state of the game or the state of a part of our product, because I work on a product now that is live. We're continuing to work on it.
Yeah.
We have a bunch of different games in the suite that is this product.
Yeah.
It is a chance for me and in general to step back and look at a part of the product or a single game critically,
mm-hmm.
before making suggestions on if or how to work on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And usually it comes out of an intention for the game or for the product.
Right.
And a lot of this also comes from the fact that as a designer, I have to be a couple steps forward of the rest of the team. So that way I don't bottleneck people, but also so that way we have a better sense of what is going to be on the roadmap.
Yeah.
So that way then, for example, hey, do we need to make any dev investigations in order to address this thing? Because we don't actually know what we would do.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to do that first? Can we jump into development? If so, where would we put it? How does this relate to other initiatives that we're working on?
Okay. Can I ask, does this to me sounds like a code review, but like for design? Does that sound similar to what you're talking about?
I've never done a code review, so I don't know.
So effectively what a code review is like somebody else looks at your code and analyzes it and makes sure that like it does what it's supposed to do and is also up to quote unquote code with respect to like the guidelines that the developers have set. I don't really do a lot of code reviews because I've oftentimes worked by myself.
It's something that's much more common outside of games.
Yeah.
It's common inside of games.
It is.
In larger studios, but I think a lot of indie developers don't know it as well.
Right, right. But effectively, it's just making sure that like what you have done will still work. And it's still good for the future of.
Yeah, I think kind of.
Okay.
Yes, I imagine it will. It honestly feels a little bit like I'm an inspector sometimes, where I come in and I essentially go, "Hey, here's what's up."
Yeah.
Which is good, especially for a long term product. You end up getting change blindness, or you're working so intensely on one thing that you kind of have to remember what everything else looks like.
Yes.
Right.
And especially with this, where it's a product with a lot of different games,
that can
happen quite often. I know that in part I have been tapped for it as well because I'm one of the newer people on the team.
Sure.
And as a game designer, my job is to think about it very holistically and mm-hmm. think about the product experience as a whole. That's oftentimes what I'm tapped in for at work because we're not working on a game right now.
Right.
It what does this include? Well, usually it comes in with an intention, so I try to write down questions that we have that I want to make sure I definitely will cover.
Yeah.
Usually it has like a reason of, hey, we want to look at this because we're doing this and I want to record that. But in general, what it includes, I like to have it usually is a document, but I will walk through it. I'll present my findings at the end, but it's an analysis document. I will start with like an overall assessment. I will then usually talk about like, what is the thing? How does it work?
Yeah.
Its strengths, its weaknesses, kind of what its role is and how well it's doing it. any existing documentation or any knowledge about it that I can find, if there is no documentation, I'll try to make sure that I find it or link it or record it in some way, especially if that document, if that knowledge is oral tradition, which so often happens with teams, we know. And oral tradition gets lost. I'll have recommendations for paths forward and a room for miscellaneous observations. So this is where I'll put like, hey, I think I found a bug, or like, ah, I think this thing doesn't really work, but it's not that important. Or it's like a footnote, but hey, we should probably change this, or I would want to change this. And I also usually have a section for my raw notes and my data that I keep as a separate area.
Yeah. I realized as you were talking that this is very similar to the last class I took in college. I mean, literally 6 months ago, so it's not that. It sounds like it's far. The UX experience class that I took, I did a, I forgot the name of the paper, but we did a paper, we did an analysis on a website, and we like we did user testing specifically. So this isn't exactly the same.
No, this is just little old me.
But no, but we also did our own analysis of the website ourselves as as experienced testers.
Yeah.
And so we went through the website and detailed what we felt went right, what didn't work, and we listed specific citations based off of other experts, and sent that information as part of this paper, as part of this development. So it sounds a lot like what you're doing in that, like you're analyzing what works about this thing, such that you can make changes if things aren't working correctly. I imagine that it is difficult if you are somebody who's also is already working on the project, because it's difficult to like recognize or to like step back and really analyze what you're doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And especially because for a lot of these devs, it was who knows when the last time they worked on this was.
Yeah.
You know, it might be the demands of a bug or a client or, you know, just something in the roadmap. That is also part of it. In the dev cycle is because I am the first person who has to do something, I am also the last person who I'm one of the first people who stops touching something, which means I'm the first person to refresh my gaze of that. And so even if I know the thing well, going back with fresh eyes again, I'm in a much better position than say a programmer who just debugs something in that game.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
So, Stephen, the example you were citing, it seems like a rubric for feedback. And that's very similar to what you're describing, Lydia, but it sounds, I think investigations is a really good term for it, because you're not just, you're not necessarily analyzing it just for what needs to improve or change, but you're like validating what works, what's successful about it. And so, what are the results of investigations in this context? Is it like... What is generally produced, like a series of recommendations or a team analysis of like, did we meet our goals?
I will typically not do, I don't do did we meet our goals in terms of like a retrospective, in part because I was not there during development.
Sure.
And I also think that that's not necessarily the place for it. I think when it comes to a retrospective, a lot of times you know what went wrong, you know what you would want to change, you know where you'd want to go, but you can't necessarily go that way. There's then distance, and then there's the question, there's a moment where it's landed, right? And you kind of get a sense of, okay, how are people actually using this or playing this? What are they doing with it? What is this game really in terms of its coming of its own? And also, how does this have the things that we want to do to it or change it, how have they changed?
Okay.
Right? So a lot of what I end up doing and writing about it is how it works and why and how that relates to other goals. You know, for example, one of the things that I did for, I did an investigation on the game Detective, which part of why it never got, doesn't get touched very often is because it was not designed in a way that can be easily reskinned for, you know, corporate branding, which means that a programmer hasn't gone in just to swap art assets in years, which means that no one really knows how it works or how to set it up. Yeah. And because we're working currently on a new new version of the game builders to make it easier to build games, we're like, okay, well, how do you even build a detective game? What is even this game?
Yeah.
So one of the things that I did, because it's a deductive puzzle game, I actually spend a moment where I say, I have a section, puzzle design as it relates to detective. And I say, the beginning of that section, a good puzzle must be three things. Democratic, anyone can solve it from the given information and nothing beyond. Tricky, fair. Once you know the answer, it is obvious why it's the answer. So then I go into say, when I make deduction puzzles, I make them backwards.
Yeah.
I start with the answer, I map out the information, and then I add, that leads to the answer, and then I add the distractors in.
Sure.
To make a good detective case, you would then have to follow a similar process. And then I outline in the words of the components of the game, how you would go about doing this.
Okay.
And then I point out, like, you know, that it needs to be tricky, but it must be fair.
Yeah.
Here's why you need to do it. And this is exactly the inverse of how we build our games. Mm-hmm. You have to build it. In order for it to be good, you have to go backwards. And most people are not game designers. They don't know this. I had to learn how to do this when I started doing puzzle design for escape rooms.
Yeah.
And so that kind of talking shop if I can kind of get that out there, it both explains a little bit of like why it is valuable, but also where the complications are.
Sure.
Yeah.
Not just like in terms of, well, what are we trying to deal with right now, which is we have to figure out how to make a builder for it. But also, what could we do with it? One of the things is like, oh, hey, is there a way that we could like make a templatized thing or some form of AI agent that we're working with where it's like, hey, I have the intention to do this. Here is the data. How can you make, can it make a puzzle for you? A starting point, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then you can then, it makes the path and you can add distractors or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that possible? Is that something we want to pursue? Is that an opportunity?
Yeah.
I also will, you know, oftentimes just take the opportunity to reemphasize things that are already known.
Yeah.
So existing customer complaints or things that we know are bad. I'll be like, hey, if we can change this, it would be awesome. Like, this is worthwhile. And just put more, you know, fuel on that little fire, that cause. I will also tend to reframe how we think of something.
Yeah.
And try to use that different language. So that way, my intent is that I leave behind reasoning behind why something is in the moment that I write about it.
Yeah.
I also try to be kind of snarky sometimes and funny because, man, I mean, one of these, I'm looking at the documents right now. One of them is 9 pages long and one of them is 6 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
So I have one right now where it's like, the header is XP is useless in this use case. Yep.
Yeah. I'm curious. I would like to try to use this in other contexts as well, because I think that like it is this like analyzing what you've been doing and recognizing whether or not you're going in the right direction, and someone being able to lay it out for you is super valuable, right?
Yeah.
But oftentimes you have to like go to get playtest feedback, and playtesters aren't necessarily trained in this kind of thing.
No.
They're also not necessarily evaluating against the goals of the team.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And so like I think that like this kind of process can be useful in the full development process,
mm-hmm.
I suppose, in terms of recognizing problems that you're having early.
Yeah.
But it's really difficult to do that when you're like, if you're like a solo developer, it would be extremely difficult.
Yeah, right? I think I could imagine a version of this rubric, which you can sort of play act someone who is new to the experience, but of course you are in full knowledge of the goals of it. And you can kind of, I mean, it requires a sort of like dispassionate role play.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, people do that
mm-hmm.
When they do role playing games.
Yeah.
Like, there's, it's hard to step aside, but when you have like a specific framework of these are the questions you're asking and answering, you can maybe think more critically about your own work.
Perhaps.
I mean, I don't think it's easy, but
no.
I could see it being, I think this is useful to know about whether you can apply it to your own work or not. I think it's an interesting framework, but I do wonder if it's applicable even on small teams or single teams.
I feel like, I mean, Lydia, you could speak to it better because you're the expert. But it feels like it could be applicable even in smaller teams. I think it would be really difficult for a solo dev, but like there are ways that you can like grammar check your own essays or whatever by like reading it backwards. Isn't that a thing that people do? Or maybe I'm misremembering how it works.
I'm gonna look that up.
What?
Okay. I remember like or maybe you're looking for spelling errors or something. Maybe because it would be difficult to find grammar.
We would, at the Writing Center in college, we would read aloud our papers.
Because reading them aloud
is easier. And also, if you read it to someone, you pretend that like someone on the subway picked up your paper because it fell out of your bag and read it through that lens.
Yeah.
That's one of the ways.
Yeah.
I think actually where this would be the thing is that this type of analysis really does require you to have some form of outside perspective.
Yeah.
I really do think you need to have a removal of the urgency of doing something, solving problems now.
Okay.
Sure.
In the sense of like, this can't be, we need to fix this right now. We need to go in and figure out what that means.
Yeah. Okay.
Where I actually think that this could be useful is if you have something and you want to make improvements, decide if you're going to make improvements on it, mm-hmm. decide if you're going to make DLC for it. Mm. Are you going to make a sequel? And if you want to make a sequel, what does that look like?
Yeah.
I think that actually that would probably be the best use case for it.
Sure.
Yeah. That's a really creative application for this.
I don't even think it necessarily has to be something like a sequel or DLC. I think you can use it for our future games too. Like okay. Hit these marks, if you didn't hit it, why didn't you hit it? And you can mm-hmm. understand why and change that process. When your first game was an MMO, how dare you? If your first game was an MMO and your next game is a fighting game, what are you doing? I don't know. I'm already going off the rails. And if you're making two very different games, you can analyze the process in which you did it and making sure that like your design goals were met.
Yeah.
And then you can use that same process to make sure that your design goals are met in this future game, regardless of whether or not it's a sequel or not.
It could be a useful thing for scope as well if you're working on different sequences or levels.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, not necessarily to go back and change something you've already done because time's up for that.
Yeah.
You're settled, you're happy.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
But you still want to investigate whether, you know, what could be done better the next time out.
Yeah.
Because you've got three more levels to make.
Yeah, I love that.
I also think potentially maybe this is how you could implement it midway through development. Mm-hmm. Again, I have not done this. I don't know. If you end up doing this, please let me know if this works. I know that sometimes devs will have a period of time that they just allocate, like a sprint that is just for playtesting. Mm. But they'll get other people on the team or other people in the company, and it's like, hey, we are just going to do playtesting for this thing.
Yeah.
During that time, that might actually be very valuable to have the moment to go, okay, the holistic view, I'm going to take that time and analyze where are we?
Yeah.
Because I think that that is part of the problem is when you are so focused on implementing something small, you kind of look up and go, oh, wait a second, how did I get here? Or where am I? Mm-hmm. What time is it? What day is it? And that can then be a really good indication of with the remaining scope we have, what do we want to do with it? What has it become? Mm-hmm. Is there value in it? It may be that it's different than what you intended, but if it's good and you recognize that it's good, you know, that is a very valuable thing to know because then you can argue, hey, this is what it is now. I think we should keep pursuing this or flesh it out in this way.
Yeah.
But I think it really does require that allowance to not have anyone touch it and just be able to look at it. Yeah. That's one of the things that I'm afforded is because these investigations are done well ahead of it's going to be on our sprint. Right?
Sure.
Like who knows if when on the roadmap this is going to happen?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. But like the possibility of this could be, and if so, and if it is valuable enough, what will the work look like? What would the Jira tickets look like? What would be the things we do? That is what I'm trying to identify and narrow.
Yeah.
Which then can be further refined with scope, where it's like, okay, well, we can't do all of these things. What do we feel is most important based on what we found in the investigation?
Yeah.
I will also say that one of the things that I did most recently, for the last investigation I did last sprint, was I actually did some data analysis, which is, as we know, I'm not great with numbers. I tried. And so I actually went in and found some customer data and I recorded it. I did a lot, like there were a couple days where I just did like copy and pasting into a different spreadsheet. I was trying to identify certain quantitative variables that then I could glean some qualitative data from or just like that would be useful.
Yeah.
And so part of that was one, I now have a spreadsheet that with actual data from customers in a certain range that I have as part of these investigation notes, as well as some very simple like analysis that I have pulled from that. But I also added a specific field in this document right at the top that is investigation process. I begin by saying I, parenthesis, Lydia Simchich game designer, because one of the things is we can't always remember which game designer designed certain games.
Oh, yeah.
Because these are so old.
Yeah.
And I don't know who, like, there's no documentation.
Right.
And they're
right.
trying to remember who even had the ideas.
Oh, you are properly doing an investigation.
Yes. No, I am. I am deep diving. I did interviews with people to try and get, like, I actually have in my notes an oral history of this part of the product. Just trying to talk to one of the devs who was around and see anything of like, well, what were you intending to make?
Dang.
Because we don't have anything.
Sherlock Holmes over here.
Yeah, for real. Anyway, so it's like, who the heck am I?
Yeah.
Did the following part of this investigation. And then I wrote down step by step what my process was.
Yeah.
And also what I did a data process overview where it's like, hey, this is what I did with this is what I collected for the data. Mm. This is why, and this is what I did with it with these intentions.
Yeah, yeah.
In part, so that way then someone can go in and who is better with numbers and spreadsheets and go, oh, wait, what? Why did she do it that way? I think we should do it this way.
Yeah.
Or if anything, so that way then whoever's next then knows what on earth I was trying to do.
Right.
And then also what I did is I, you know, said, hey, if you continue this process, here's what I would do because I don't know how or I don't have the information.
Oh, my gosh. Design is just like code.
And so?
Everything is everything.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I very much try to give. Like really center in on the reasons and the whys and what I think is happening.
Yeah.
And that is one of the things I think it's really valuable in part because, you know, I always say use the right tool for the job, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also, ideally, you are making something that addresses a need or addresses a want. If you don't know what the need or the want is, what are you doing? Because you're just wasting time, you're wasting money, you're making something that just is bullshit, right? It doesn't need to exist. Or you're blatantly ignoring or just brushing off actual things and concerns from the people that you would want to benefit, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is very much what I try to do.
Yeah.
I think you can do this as qualitatively or quantitatively as you want, but I think having both is good.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I end with recommendations. So some of it will be, hey, if we did this effort, which we were talking about, here's how I would do it. Or I have these questions and I don't know how to answer them. I think I would want a programmer to try and do these things.
Yeah.
In the one that I just did, I was like, hey, literally, header, track more data, comma, better. Because some of the things that I found is like, oh, I don't know why the data was recorded this way.
Right.
I don't understand why these numbers are the way they are in relation to each other. Or I can't find how to find this info and it would be really useful.
Right.
Like, you know, how, like, for example, when was the last time someone played this? Just the date of the last time someone played this in relation to when it was made and when it was last edited.
Right.
That would be really nice.
Yeah.
We don't have that.
Mm.
And that is something that, like, you know, isn't a product, isn't a thing that would be good for the customer necessarily, but would be really helpful for us.
Right.
So that way then we have better info for later.
Yes. I this has opened my eyes because I had not had any understanding on like this kind of a thing. I've never done it in the past. But it definitely sounds like it's really valuable.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, it's kind of interesting how both of the topics we talked about today are involve contexts. Like, it's important to recognize the context that you're working in and the context of what you're building in order for you to make decisions or improve what you're making or, you know, make sure that you are reaching the right audience, things like that.
I mean, it's like in science where there's two types of, I think there's two types of studies. Again, it's been a while, but there's the observational kind and then there's the kind that is like a hypothesis experiment.
Yeah.
So what I'm very much talking about is the observational one.
Right.
And quite often the results of an observational study can inform later experiments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They can highlight places where or holes of knowledge and things that you want to then try and do.
Yeah.
That's where you then go into prototyping and playtesting.
Mm-hmm.
Or you then may realize, oh dang, we have data. We have the wrong data.
Yeah.
We have been playtesting the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
and how that can then help narrow down your intent and focus for example, your events or whatever.
Yeah.
Who do you even go, which events do you go to? Who do you even talk to? Stuff like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode or others or whatever with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be interviewing Andrew Plotkin about interactive fiction communities. But that's it for this week.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.